The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight, with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
It is a chilling day in American history, and not just because I keep this theater at 52 degrees. For the first time ever, a president has used the power of his office to punish members of the intelligence community who have criticized him. Specifically, former CIA Director John Brennan. Now, presidential spokesperson Sarah Huckabee read the president's statement today about Brennan from the official White House lion perch.
As the head of the executive branch and commander-in-chief, I have a unique constitutional responsibility to protect the nation's classified information, including by controlling access to it. Today, in fulfilling that responsibility, I have decided to revoke the security clearance of John Brennan, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
This means Brennan can't read classified intelligence. So now the only place he'll read threats against America is on Trump's Twitter feed. And the official reason Trump gave for revoking Brennan's clearance, Brennan, quote, leveraged his status to make a series of unfounded and outrageous allegations, including wild outbursts on the internet. Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah. Same. I'd say that's the pot calling the kettle black, but there may be tapes of it calling the kettle something much worse. But that's a fine family joke. Fine.
Leaning on the law.
But here's the thing. They've been talking about doing this thing for a month. Doing it today is just an obvious attempt to distract our attention from America's sweetheart, Omarosa. Omarosa says she's heard a tape of Trump saying the N-word. He denies saying it, but it has still spawned a national debate. Exactly how big of a racist is the president? I mean, on a scale of drunk uncle on Thanksgiving to drunk uncle at Trump rally. Now, at yesterday's press conference, Sarah Huckabee Sanders insisted the president is not a racist, and she had proof.
I think if, again, the person that a lot of his critics say he is, certainly wouldn't have been in business with him for decades.
What?
Certainly, you wouldn't have had Bill and Hillary Clinton. They attended his wedding.
What?
Yeah.
Huh?
He can't be a racist. Some of his best friends are people who have black friends. But
there you go.
Don't just take Huckasan's word that Trump isn't a racist. Take it from Trump's biggest defender.
I am the least racist person that you have ever met.
I'm probably the least racist person there is.
I am the least racist person you have ever interviewed.
I am the least racist person. Racism. The least racist person.
And you can tell somebody's not something when they protest.
Yeah.
Exactly the right amount.
Oh, boy. All right. Thank you, Stephen Colbert, for giving us a few giggles at the beginning of the show. We've got more to say about the whole John Brennan security clearance thing. And it's Thursday, so Howie Klein will be along to celebrate big progressive wins Tuesday in the primaries. Sad news started our day today as we learned that Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, died. You know, she, what I learned is, I didn't know this before. I knew she was sick. We heard it for the last few days that she'd been in hospice, you know, with family and friends by her side. She died from pancreatic cancer. It's the same thing that took our friend Joel Silberman. That's a deadly, deadly form of cancer. And just what a loss. Of course, you know, Donald Trump, who hasn't had a nice word to say about any black people in recent history, he, at the beginning of his cabinet meeting today, actually weighed in on Aretha. And he had to lie about her, too.
In today by expressing my condolences to the family of a person I knew well.
You knew well? Yeah, right.
She worked for me on numerous occasions. She was terrific. Aretha Franklin on
her
passing.
He worked for you on numerous occasions? Somehow I doubt that is true. You know, if it comes out of Donald Trump's mouth, it, pretty good chance that there's nothing truthful about it. But somebody who worked for me on a number of occasions? Sorry, Aretha didn't work for you, you pig. I don't even want to hear anymore. Yeah, because everything he says is phony. Horrible. And why sully the memory? Everybody, I mean, both the CNN and MSNBC broke programming for probably at least 2 hours this morning and went wall to wall Aretha. And they were reading tweets by people who loved her. Look, Aretha Franklin is, you know, there are very few who rise to her level of stardom of you know, music royalty. And it's just a weird coincidence, I guess, that Elvis Presley, known as the King of Rock and Roll, died on this date. I think it was 1977, August 16th. And then the Queen of Soul dies August 16th, 2018. The best thing about, you know, people like Aretha Franklin is that their music lives on forever. And yeah, we'll always have that. Oh, sad day. All right. I don't know where else to go other than let's head into what's news, shall we?
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
When you open your local newspaper to the op-ed page this morning, and you do subscribe to a local newspaper, right? Chances are pretty good that you'll see an editorial pushing back on Donald Trump's repeated attacks on the media. The Boston Globe last week called for newspapers nationwide to band together on this day to fight back against Trump's, quote, war on the free press. The Globe said that more than 350 outlets had committed to writing their own unique editorial challenging the president. Even the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Post published its own, saying, quote, we stand with our colleagues. And I thought, why not? And I closed it. I'm such a doofus. I did have the New York Times one open. And somehow I closed it. But let me pull it up for you real fast. And I will share what the New York Times wrote. The headline for their op-ed today is "A Free Press Needs You." In 1787, the year the Constitution was adopted, Thomas Jefferson famously wrote to a friend, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." That's how he felt before he became president. Anyway. 20 years later, after enduring the oversight of the press from inside the White House, he was less sure of its value. Quote, nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper, he wrote. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle. Jefferson's discomfort was and remains understandable. Reporting the news in an open society is an enterprise laced with conflict. His discomfort also illustrates the need for the right he helped enshrine. As the founders believed from their own experience, a well-informed public is best equipped to root out corruption and, over the long haul, promote liberty and justice. Public discussion is a political duty. The Supreme Court said that in 1964. That discussion must be, quote, uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials. In 2018, some of the most damaging attacks are coming from government officials. Criticizing the news media for underplaying or overplaying stories, for getting something wrong, is entirely right. News reporters and editors are human and make mistakes. correcting them is core to our job. But insisting that truths you don't like are, quote, fake news is dangerous to the lifeblood of democracy. And calling journalists the enemy of the people is dangerous, period. These attacks on the press are particularly threatening to journalists in nations with a less secure rule of law and to smaller publications in the United States already buffeted by the industry's economic crisis. And yet the journalists at those papers continue to do the hard work of asking questions and telling the stories that you otherwise wouldn't hear. Consider the San Luis Obispo Tribune, which wrote about the death of a jail inmate who was restrained for 46 hours. The account forced the county to change how it treats mentally ill prisoners. Answering a call last week from the Boston Globe, the Times is joining hundreds of newspapers from large metro area dailies to small local weeklies to remind readers of the value of America's free press. These editorials, some of which we've excerpted, together affirm a fundamental American institution. If you haven't already, please subscribe to your local papers. Praise them when you think they've done a good job and criticize them when you think they could do better. We're all in this together. So that's the New York Times contribution to today's massive show of solidarity from newspapers around the country, all printing their own editorial in support of the free press, the Fourth Estate. And at the bottom of the New York Times editorial, they have a filter, and you can filter by location, so you can pull up your state. So, for instance, I'll go to Florida, and I hit Florida, and then below it show up excerpts from editorials from all of Florida's newspapers who participated, including our local rag. It is a rag, the Sun Sentinel, and the Miami Herald. You know, the Miami Herald wrote, "It's not just that we dislike being called fake news. That misnomer discredits facts and creates what Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway called alternative facts, making reasoned and informed debate basically impossible." The Sun Sentinel, the Broward County paper here, wrote, "Our country's leader shouldn't be making it easier for dictators to harass and silence journalists in places where freedom of the press remains a dream." So, yeah, today's a good day to head over to the New York Times and their editorial page. And if you look under their editorial, "A Free Press Needs You," at the bottom, you can search by your state and see what your local newspapers wrote. So there's that. Back to what's news. This morning, the U.S. Senate, I love this, passed a resolution with unanimous consent by voice vote that, quote, affirms that the press is not the enemy of the people and reaffirms the vital and indispensable role that the free press serves and condemns the attacks on the institution of the free press. It's nice of the Senate to speak out in support of a free press. It would be nicer if they did something that had teeth to it, like I don't know what. You can't say that Trump can't, you know, attack the press, but I don't know, make the protections something, that is tangible. All right, on to other stories. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders announced yesterday that former CIA Director John Brennan's security clearance is being revoked. Sanders opened Wednesday's press briefing by reading from a prepared statement from the president.
"Mr. Brennan has recently leveraged his status as a former high-ranking official with access to highly sensitive information to make a series of unfounded and outrageous allegations, wild outbursts on the internet and television about this administration. Mr. Brennan's lying and recent conduct, characterized by increasingly frenzied commentary, is wholly inconsistent with access to the nation's most closely held secrets and facilities, the very aim of our adversaries, which is to sow division and chaos. More broadly, the issue of Mr. Brennan's security clearance raises larger questions about the practice of former officials maintaining access to our nation's most sensitive secrets long after their time in government has ended. Such access is particularly inappropriate when former officials have transitioned into highly partisan positions and seek to use real or perceived access to sensitive information to validate their political attacks. Any access granted to our nation's secrets should be in furtherance of national, not personal interest. For this reason, I've also begun to review the more general question of the access to classified information by government officials. As part of this review, I am evaluating action with respect to the following individuals: James Clapper, James Comey, Michael Hayden, Sally Yates, Susan Rice, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, and Bruce Orr. Security clearances for those who still have them may be revoked, and those who have already lost their security clearance may not be able to have it reinstated. It is for the foregoing reasons that I have exercised my constitutional authority to deny Mr. Brennan access to classified information, and I will direct appropriate staff of the National Security Council to make the necessary arrangements with the appropriate agencies to implement this determination.
Ugh. That statement was dated July 26th, prompting many critics to question if they were holding this to use for when the White House was trying to distract the media from another story, like, oh, you know, maybe Omarosa and her tapes. Yeah. Reporters noted that the list of those who are now under review are all people who've been critical of the president.
How is this announcement by the president? How can Americans not interpret that as a getting back against his critics? And isn't it also an attempt to curtail their freedom of speech by penalizing them for being critical on television?
Not at all. The president has a constitutional responsibility to protect classified information, and who has access to it.
Who protects
and
it from
that's
him?
What he's doing is fulfilling that responsibility in this action. This is action only specific to Mr. Brennan, and the others are currently under review.
Is this the kind of precedent he wants to set for future presidents when his administration is out of office? And why are there no Republicans on that list?
Once again, if we deemed it necessarily, we would certainly look into that and be happy to review those.
Reports say that the announcement took everyone by surprise, even the director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, and the new CIA director, Gina Haspel. Neither of them had a clue. Brennan himself never received official notification.
I was called by a friend and associate when Sarah Huckabee Sanders was giving that statement. So I had no knowledge of it beforehand. No one contacted me. Nobody reached out to me over the past several weeks when this issue was first surfaced. So the first I heard about it was when I was able to turn on the television and listen to Ms. Sanders. And I have not heard anything from any government official since then or before then. So I'm just watching the news, and
amazing.
I'm so glad that you and other members of the Fourth Estate are carrying out your responsibilities to report information to the American people.
It's called Distraction 101. Upon learning the news, Brennan took to Twitter and wrote, "This action is part of a broader effort by Mr. Trump to suppress freedom of speech and punish critics. It should gravely worry all Americans, including intelligence professionals, about the cost of speaking out. My principles are worth far more than clearances. I will not relent." Then he went on MSNBC and told us what he really thought.
I do believe that Mr. Trump decided to take this action, as he's done with others, to try to intimidate and suppress any criticism of him or his administration. And revoking my security clearances is his way of trying to get back at me. But I think I have tried to voice the concerns of millions of Americans about Mr. Trump's failures in terms of fulfilling the responsibilities of that sacred and solemn office of the presidency. And this is not going to deter me at all. I'm going to continue to speak out. But I am very worried about the message that it appears that Mr. Trump is trying to send to others, and including those that currently hold security clearances.
Yep.
Within the government. I think he included Bruce Orr, the current Department of Justice official, among those whose clearances he's reviewing. Is this an effort to try to cow individuals, both inside and outside of the government, to make sure that they don't say anything either that is critical of Mr. Trump or with which he disagrees? And I've seen this type of behavior and actions on the part of foreign tyrants and despots and autocrats for many, many years during my CIA and national security career. I never, ever thought that I would see it here in the United States.
Hmm.
And so I do believe that all Americans really need to take stock of what is happening right now in our government and how abnormal and how irresponsible and how dangerous these actions are. So, again, if Mr. Trump believes that this is going to lead me to just go away and be quiet, he is very badly mistaken.
Very badly mistaken. So that's John Brennan. So he took to Twitter. He went on MSNBC, where he spoke on a number of shows. That was his first statement after hearing the news, learning about it from the White House press briefing. It's like the way Trump fires by Twitter. Brennan also hit back at the president with an op-ed in today's New York Times, in which he argues that this was, quote, an attempt to scare and to silence others who might dare to challenge him, and that the president's claim of no collusion is, quote, hogwash. Oh, okay. What else? Let's move to New York, where during a speech yesterday at a bill signing event, New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, was apparently trying to respond to Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again, but it kind of backfired.
The simple point is all this comes down to this. We're not going to make America great again. It was never that great.
Did you hear the crowd? So he said that it was never that great. He made the comments in the context of a larger argument about gender equality and women achieving their full potential. Here's the rest of what he was trying to say.
We have not reached greatness. We will reach greatness when every American is fully engaged. We will reach greatness when discrimination and stereotyping against women, 51% of our population, is gone. And every woman's full potential is realized and unleashed, and every woman is making her full contribution. When that happens, this nation is going to be taken even higher, because we have not yet fully liberated the women in this country. And we will. And New York will lead the way, and watch New York rise.
Yeah,
thank
hopefully,
you. God bless.
Hopefully, with a new female governor, as Cuomo faces Democrat Cynthia Nixon in a primary for the gubernatorial seat. Andrew Cuomo, sorry, you're no Mario. Just I loved his father. I worked with his father when I was a young radio producer in New York, and Mario Cuomo was the governor of New York, and I used to produce he did a statewide call-in show that I produced with him every month. And Mario Cuomo couldn't have been a kinder, nicer, more genuine man. And his son Andrew is nothing like him. Just saying. There is more news. Omarosa was back at MSNBC today. She brought along another tape. Yes, she did. This time it was Laura Trump, who's the one that's married to Eric, who's working on the campaign. And it's a tape of Laura Trump trying to buy Omarosa off. So this was a couple of days after she was fired. And Laura Trump is offering her a job, a quote, job on the campaign.
But listen, obviously with like the New York Times article and stuff, you know, it's
what's the New York Times article?
The one that it was in the New York Times today, I guess you did with Maggie Haberman, or they wrote about you. It sounds a little like obviously that there's something you got in the back pocket to pull out. Clearly, if you come over with the campaign, like we can't have it. We gotta everybody's positive, right? And so the only thing that we have to consider when we're talking salary as far as the campaign is concerned is that, as you know, everything is public. And all the money that we raise and that pays salaries is directly from donors, small dollar donors for the most part. So I know you were making
$179,000.
And I think we could work something out where we keep you right along those lines.
Wow.
Specifically, let me see, I haven't even added up the numbers, but we were talking about like $15K a month. Let me see what that adds up to. 12. Yeah, so that's $180,000. Does that sound like a fair deal for you? In terms of your position specifically, I really feel like your position would require, you know, you to be able to be flexible in terms of where you are. Sometimes, you know, come to New York for occasional meetings, but I would love if you could, you know, occasionally go do speaking engagements and that sort of thing for us. I think you'd be awesome doing that. And so it doesn't really matter where you are. If you're comfortable staying in D.C., then, you know, we're more than happy to have you.
And it cuts off right there. It's obviously an edited tape, although on MSNBC they said that she brought four tapes. I guess she pulled excerpts from, but that's the gist of it. Laura Trump offering her $15,000 a month for a job on the campaign. That would be pretty flexible, you know. It would come out to $180,000 a year, which is a little more than she was making at the White House. Nothing fishy there. We'll see what else she's got up her sleeve. I don't know. There is other news. I remember the Masterpiece Cake Shop, the one that the Supreme Court ruled in favor of them, that they didn't have to make, this baker didn't have to bake a cake for a gay couple. Well, now that man, the owner, Jack Phillips, is this time suing Colorado, the state of Colorado, this time for investigating his refusal to bake a cake celebrating a gender transition. Phillips brought the latest lawsuit against civil rights officials and Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper Tuesday night. In June, as I mentioned, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Phillips in his same-sex wedding cake case. But that court ruling was specific to that one case only. In this case, Phillips declined to make a cake for a transgender woman named Autumn Scardina in June. She requested a cake that's blue on the outside and pink on the inside to reflect her male-to-female transition as she was coming out as transgender on her birthday. The Colorado Civic Rights Commission argued that Scardina was denied equal enjoyment of a place of public accommodation. The attorney, I guess, for this bakery, which represents, right, the baker, said the state of Colorado is ignoring the message of the U.S. Supreme Court by continuing to single out Jack for punishment and to exhibit hostility toward his religious beliefs. Ugh, why do people go to that shop anyway? I'm sorry, if I wouldn't want to give this guy my business. You got to figure there are other good bakers in Denver. Why go to this guy? I wouldn't give him a dime. Jury deliberations began this morning in Paul Manafort's trial on bank and tax fraud charges with no clear sign of how long it'll take before a verdict is reached. U.S. District Court Judge T.S. Ellis III sent the 12-person jury off with a lengthy list of instructions on how they are to weigh reams of evidence and testimony delivered by special counsel Robert Mueller's prosecutors and the former Trump campaign chairman's lawyers over the course of the 2+ week trial in Alexandria, Virginia. Apparently, after 5 hours of deliberation, there were no questions or anything, but the jury did ask for a bigger room so they have more space to spread out in. We'll see how long this goes. And finally, you'll love this one. Trump's military parade is now estimated to cost $92 million. That's $80 million more than an earlier estimate. I kid you not. Donald Trump's military parade this fall, apparently it is in the planning stages, and it's shaping up to cost $80 million more than initially estimated. The Department of Defense and its interagency partners have updated their prospective cost estimates for this ridiculous parade, according to a U.S. defense official with firsthand knowledge of the assessment. The parade, slated for November 10th, is estimated to cost $92 million. The figure includes $50 million from the Pentagon and $42 million from interagency partners such as the Department of Homeland Security. An initial estimate last month pegged the prospective cost for the parade at $12 million. How do they justify such an outrageous waste of money? There are hungry people. There are children who go to bed hungry at night in this country. This is criminal. And that's a bit of what's news for now. And, I could keep going, but I won't because it's almost time for Howie Klein. So we'll take a quick break and we'll come back on the other side with Howie Klein. And we'll go over what happened on Tuesday and what's still to come. It's the Nicole Sandler Show at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
Are you a multinational corporation hungry for a treat? Well, come on down to Schmucky Chucky's, where you'll personally be seated by Chuck Schumer himself.
So many dishes, and they're all fresh.
You're gonna love our Blue Dog special, the Dino Burger, because we say so.
A good hamburger and french fries.
And every burger comes with a side order of...
grits. I love grits. I love anything with corn. It's corn.
All for only $50,000. Wash it all down with a Dirty Debbie.
9/10 water, 1/10 orange juice. After a week or two, you drink this, it's 200 calories and it's acetic.
And wipe your mouth with a tissue print of Glass-Steagall. For dessert, try our DNC tarts.
Little cookies, tell the quality of that.
Most restaurants give you a mint, but at Schmucky Chucky's, you get complimentary.
Sweet and low.
Who picks up the tab for all this? Find out now with Howie Klein of DownWithTyranny.com on The Nicole Sandler Show.
It is Thursday, so we get to hang out with Howie Klein of Down With Tyranny and the Blue America PAC and talk about what's going on in our country's primaries. I think we had a pretty good day Tuesday. Hi, Howie Klein.
Hi, how you doing, Nicole? And we certainly did have a good day on Tuesday.
We did. Saturday was not great. Kenyella Ng did not win his primary in Hawaii, but I saw an amazing tweet from him with a great attitude saying something along the lines of, this was only the first time that he's run for office, and he's not going anywhere, basically.
And as he pointed out, well, not for office, but first time he ran for Congress.
Or for Congress.
And as he pointed out, the first time Obama ran for Congress, he lost the first time. Bernie ran for Congress, mm-hmm. he lost. I mean, mm-hmm. he had a bunch of people that he mentioned who lost the first time. And we could go back and say also the first time Alan Grayson ran for Congress, he lost. And mm-hmm. it's very common that people lose the first time they run. It's much more common that they the second time. I remember when we worked very, very hard on Donna Edwards,
right.
and she lost the first
uh-huh.
time. Or it was stolen from her the first time, and then she came back and ran the second time, and she won.
Okay, so
yesterday we were discussing future plans and how he could, come back from this. And here we are, just a couple of days after, and he's already up and fighting. He also got an incredible job offer, which I'm very excited about. I'll have to let him announce that when he's ready to.
Oh, okay.
But life looks good for him. Plus, his incredible, brilliant wife just got a really good job as well.
Oh, that's nice. So that's good. And we'll definitely be hearing from him more in the future. This is not the yeah. last of Kenyella Ng.
But going back to Tuesday,
yes.
we had some really, really excellent news, both for the Democrats in general and specifically for progressives. So those were two good things. The overall thing that I was the most excited about is that in every single state, I mean, there was Vermont, Connecticut, Wisconsin, and Minnesota that all voted, and in all four of those states, the Democratic turnout, or I shouldn't say the Democratic turnout, but the number of people who voted for Democrats far outpaced the number of people who voted for Republicans. And what that means is actually better than Democratic turnout, because what it means is that the Democrats plus independents who voted for Democrats was much greater than Republicans and independents who voted for Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a much more important metric of us to look and see what is likely to happen in November.
Randy Bryce had a big win.
Yes, Randy had a very very nice win, and I think you and I have talked about this before, but there are Republican billionaires who have specifically started targeting Democratic primaries. So this has been happening all over the country, where they're putting in immense amounts of money into Democratic primaries. Generally speaking, or I should say not generally, always in every case is what it is, to make conservative Democrats win. So they go into districts that are very, very, very blue, where they know there's no Republican going to win, and they try to knock out progressive Democrats mm-hmm. in order to get a blue dog. Like, that's what happened in Chicago, where Marie Newman looked like she was going to win against blue dog Lipinski. And Ben Lipinski, Dan Lipinski. I knew it was a three-letter word. So Dan Lipinski looked like he was losing his seat, and then along comes all these Republican, you know, rich guys, and they put in hundreds of thousands of dollars at the last minute into the campaign, and then Marie lost. And they've been doing this all around the country. In some cases, the Republican-backed candidates are losing, and they're trying to do the same thing now in Orlando against Alan Grayson. Wow. They're spending immense amount of money to try to make sure that Darren Soto will win. And who's Darren Soto? You know, a guy who has voted twice to criminalize abortion. And when I say criminalize, it would mean if a doctor performed an abortion, he would be guilty of murder.
Oh my God!
And Darren Soto voted for that twice. Wow. He also voted for the NRA enough times to give him an A from the NRA and get him endorsed by the NRA.
Wow, wow! And that's Alan Grayson's opponent in the primary for his district in Florida.
Right. So you have, for example, this, he's not the only one who's doing it, but as one example, you have James Murdoch. So he's the one that now runs Fox News.
Uh-huh.
You have James Murdoch putting in $500,000 against Allen.
Wow.
And they're doing the same thing in Tucson, where you know, a very, very right-wing Democrat, Ann Kirkpatrick, also a huge NRA supporter, and she was in Congress before, so we know how she'll be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, terrible right-wing Democrat. And this, and again, you know, Murdoch and that whole crew of Wall Street billionaires are spending money to make sure she gets the seat. You know, we have, in other words, what I'm saying is we have rich Republicans trying to determine how Democratic primaries come out. And the DCCC is perfectly happy with that because they're backing the same candidates as the DCCC backs. I mean, we're talking about a primary. We're not talking about a general election.
Mm-hmm.
And in Arizona, the second district, the Tucson area, the DCCC long ago endorsed Ann Kirkpatrick, even though she's by far the most conservative person running, and that's who the Republicans want to win this seat also. So you know they see eye to eye, the DCCC and the Republican billionaires, they see it the same way. So anyway, that's, you know, that has me you know, jumping up and down and yelling, but
yes,
not many people have attention, to tell you the truth.
Well, let's talk about some of the other races. And we mentioned Randy Bryce won. Do you know about the guy?
And the reason I brought that up is because it was the same thing in Randy's district,
right?
Where it was a slightly different reason. So, in other words, it wasn't because Randy was running against a conservative. It was that the Republicans were afraid of Randy.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want their clone of Paul Ryan to have to fight Randy because they know Randy's going to win. So what they did is there was another candidate, Kathy Meyer or Myers, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of a weak candidate. She started out as just a vanity candidate, and then she realized, well, the people around her, I don't want to blame her, the people around her realized that they could make a fortune by you know, running against Paul Ryan and getting lots of money and then paying themselves nice fat salaries, which is exactly what happened.
Wow.
So, you know, and she's not a bad person. I'm not trying to say that, but you know, she wasn't a really serious candidate, and the Republicans wanted her very much because they knew that they'd beat her without breaking a sweat. So, you know, heartbreaking for those of us, unlike her, who have been trying to defeat Ryan for over a decade.
Yes.
To see finally we have a chance to actually beat this guy. And wow, in comes this very, very weak candidate who can't win. And we've seen that again and again and again. And here's another one. But fortunately, she didn't win. But my point was that the Republicans spent thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, not giving it to her. They didn't give her the money, but they spent it to do things to hurt Randy.
Right.
And the main thing being is they developed a narrative that Randy is some kind of a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's been arrested so many times. So that's like drinking and driving and, you know, smoking a doobie and, you know, getting arrested at an anti-Scott Walker event. I mean, arrested at an anti-Scott Walker event, That's not a crime. I mean, it's not something that people are going to look down on.
No.
It's something that people will be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
But she push that narrative to them. She pushed that narrative. They were really happy with it, and then they started doing push polling. So, I mean, it's like everyone in the district has been called by them. They did the most intense push polling imaginable. When I say they, I don't mean Myers. I mean Ryan's Super PAC did the push polling.
Wow.
And spent huge amounts of money on it, just trying to hurt Randy. So there's a little bit of nervousness at the last minute, like what's going to happen? They've spent all this money. And plus, Myers is extremely negative. She doesn't really know how to campaign in a Democratic primary, so she's very, very negative. And Randy never was negative. She, you know, every time they'd have a debate, she'd be like, you know, just saying the most awful things about him, and he just kept it positive the whole time. But the part of this that upset me is that the Republicans, again, pushing a candidate that they preferred for whatever reason. Usually they're pushing a candidate because they're conservative, and she's not a conservative, and they were pushing her because they thought that they would be able to beat her without, with no problem.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to fight Randy, but then we see Randy come in and beat her by about 20 points.
Yep.
So that was
great.
That worked well. And then, of course, there are all these other races around the country that were amazing, incredible races. The one that, you know, that the media is all excited about is that by very, very, very large number, the transgender woman who was running for governor of Vermont, won.
Right.
A very crowded primary.
Mm-hmm.
And she got, I mean, again, here is a case where there is a very popular Republican governor of Vermont right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people like him.
Yeah.
He's very popular. And what happens? The Democrats, so many more Democrats voted than Republicans that's the thing that's like so incredible. But that isn't what the media is talking about. What the media is talking about is, wow, it's the first transgender woman. That's a real thing that they might want to talk about, because
mm-hmm.
it is a fairly unique kind of thing. But, you know, they're certainly obsessing over it. And, you know, God bless them. If that's what they want to obsess over, they'll obsess over it. But, I think that's a part of the population that doesn't have people to look up to in that
right.
way. So it's a really nice thing. I don't like getting into the whole identity politics thing, but, you know, this is a first. By the way, her name is Christine Hallquist,
right?
And it's a first, and she won by a huge margin. I mean, just gigantic. I mean, I think there were four people in the race, and she had more than double the number of votes of the next person.
Wow!
And not only that, but she beat Phil Scott. She got more votes than Phil Scott, who is the actual governor. And people say, well, he's too popular to take on. But I think, you know, I'm not predicting that she's going to win, but she might.
Mm.
And then speaking of identity politics, in Minnesota, they're about to elect their first Somali woman.
Yes.
So she's not just Muslim, but she's a Somali. She's a state legislator. And what happened there is that Keith Ellison decided to go for higher office, higher statewide office. I think he won his attorney general nomination.
Right.
And she stepped in to run for his seat. It was also a very, very crowded race. But I felt pretty sure that she was going to win, didn't really need our help. But she's a wonderful progressive candidate. And I mean, that's what I like, is when someone who wins this thing, it's not like you have to say, well, it's going to be the first Somali, it's going to be the first Somali woman, it's going to be the first Muslim,
mm-hmm.
woman. So, I mean, it's not, you know, that's all nice and, you know, hey, yes, nice, nice, nice. But even more important from my perspective is a really, really good progressive who has, you know, proved herself in the state legislature. And then you had people like, Pramila Jayapal, who
mm-hmm.
spent some time with her and got to know her, and telling everybody, you know, she's going to be a real asset for progressives in Congress. So that's another really good thing that happened. So and around all of these races, we had lots and lots of things like that. I mean, people weren't even aware that there was a really, really important race. Oh, you're going to kill me for this. A really, really important race in Connecticut for Congress,
yeah,
where a one member of like a multimillionaire blue dog, not blue dog, but a conservative Democrat. It was like a Me Too in reverse. She was, doing some awful things and they made her resign. So then that makes an open seat. So again, Republicans backed this, and the establishment, the Democratic establishment and Republicans backed this woman named Mary Glassman,
mm-hmm,
who's part of the establishment, a somewhat conservative, for a Connecticut, Democrat. She's somewhat conservative. And what happened was the Chamber of Commerce jumped in at the last minute. They come jumping in and endorsing her. Now, the last time the Chamber of Commerce stuck their nose into a Democratic primary, because basically the Chamber of Commerce is a Republican outfit.
Right.
And the last time they stuck their nose into a Democratic primary was Blanche Lincoln.
Uh-uh.
And it was the same thing. They wanted Blanche Lincoln, a very, very ultra-conservative Democrat, to win. They didn't want a progressive to win. And that's quite a long time ago. So they got behind this Mary Glassman, and there was there was a lot of fear because the woman who was running against Mary Glassman, I don't know how to pronounce her name exactly, but Johanna, let's just say it's
right.
Johanna,
right.
Johanna Hayes. So people didn't know if she was going to win, and as it turns out, I'll skip right to the end here. It was a landslide. She just won, and she's. She's a really, really smart African-American woman who Obama recognized as the as an important figure in the education
right.
world. And
she's
won
Teacher
of the Year.
Yeah.
And I think it was 2006. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know. 2016. Yeah, it couldn't have been 2006. She's not old enough for it to be that. Yeah. So here we're talking about someone who's going to come in to Congress who is an undisputed expert at something.
Right.
Hey, we should have more of those kind of people in Congress. So smart progressive and wins by a landslide against a conservative Democrat backed by Republicans.
Yes.
So again, this you're probably noticing there's a little bit of a theme here.
Yeah.
So I was very happy about that one, too.
As you should be. Great progressive victories in all four of those contests from Tuesday. And it doesn't need to be said, but we can say it anyway. Bernie Sanders, the most popular senator in the country, won the Democratic primary because he's up for re-election this year in Vermont with 94% of the vote, which is incredible. And he's turning it down because he's running as an independent.
Right. But he certainly didn't want a Democrat running.
Exactly.
Because there were times when he first was running for Congress. Well, the first time he ran, he lost. There was both a Democrat and a Republican ran, and he ran as an independent, and he lost. And then after that, even when he got in, he was finally elected as an independent, the Democrats would run conservative Democrats against him. And it was Governor Howard Dean eventually who said, hey, this guy is – voting with the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
He founded the Progressive Caucus, which is all Democrats. We shouldn't be running candidates against him. And that was the end of it. So the Democratic Party never really ran a Democrat against him again. Every now and then there'll be some, right-wing Democrat who'll, stick his head up and say, I'm going to run against him as I'm the real Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
This is nuts. And people in Vermont ignore it.
Right. So really good news. And to all of the, the naysayers who was like, so much for the Democratic Socialists, so much for the progressive movement. The progressive movement had a really good day on Tuesday.
They absolutely did. And everywhere. I mean,
yeah.
I don't want to, then now say, the conservative Democrats are just losing.
No.
Like they said a couple of weeks ago when the progressives did badly.
Right.
What's going to happen is that progressives do well sometimes, and the conservative Democrats do well sometimes, and that's what happens. What I'd like is that, when the voters have spoken, everybody get together, because then we have to defeat the Republicans.
Exactly.
That's why it drives me insane when, a progressive wins these races and the DCCC basically says, screw you, and then won't help.
Yeah.
They expect progressive voters to help their conservative candidates, but they adamantly refuse to help progressive candidates who win these primaries. And that just drives me insane when that happens.
As it should. As it should. So next week, on the 21st, Alaska and Wyoming have their primaries. And then the following...
Right. Nothing to pay any attention to there.
Okay.
As far as I know. But the week after... That's your hometown.
Right. That's Florida and Arizona, both on August 28th. I already voted. I actually had Tim Canova on the show yesterday because I heard from somebody who's in that district. They're the next district over from me. They're the 23rd. I'm in the 22nd. They were surprised that he wasn't on the ballot. He's not running in the primary. He's decided because of the shenanigans that the Democratic Party and the Broward supervisor of elections pulled by destroying the ballots before his campaign had a chance to, you know, at least look at them and examine them. There was a whole lawsuit that Tim Canova won about that, but he's decided just to run as an independent. And, you know, there is some concern that, you know, with him as an independent and Debbie Wasserman Schultz both on the ballot, that they could split the votes and a Republican could get in. He doesn't expect that to happen because this is such a gerrymandered, such a Democratic gerrymandered district that there probably aren't enough Republican voters in that district to make that happen.
Exactly right. That it's too blue of a district for the, even if they split the vote, there's still one of them is going to win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have this thing now where I say, you know, just hold your nose and mm-hmm. vote for any Democrat that's running in the general election. We just have to beat Trump, and we need to get a Democrat, even if it's someone that you wouldn't want to vote for, even if it's someone who you feel eventually you'll be trying to get out and on the primary, just do it.
Yep.
And there's only one exception that I have in the House, and that's Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Exactly.
And the reason for that exception is because of Tim.
Yes.
I mean, even though Tim is running as an independent, that doesn't suddenly make him not a Democrat. I mean, Tim is, you know, as soon as he gets in, he'll immediately join the Progressive Caucus.
Yep.
He'll immediately be caucusing with the Democrats.
That's right.
And he'll be a Democrat again.
Right.
So, you know, don't be fooled that, I mean, I like it, you know, because he's not going to owe the party anything.
That's right.
He's only going to owe his own constituents something. He will be working for the people of the 23rd district, not for Nancy Pelosi or Steny Hoyer or any of the party bosses. So it's even better. It's a real win-win situation if Tim wins.
Right. I mean,
he probably went into this when you spoke with him, right? Or was he too busy talking about Fort Myers?
No, well, he was in Fort Myers when we spoke. He went out there. Just a horrendous situation with the red tide and the blue-green toxic algae. It's disgusting.
No, he told me about it.
Oh, it's horrible. But no, I had him on for a long time. So, you know, he talked about all of that. And Tim's such a good guy. And whenever, you know, I venture out to an event or a Democratic Club meeting or something like that, I always see him. He's out and about and doing the legwork. I just, you know, he could use some money. So if people can afford to give him money, he could really use it. His fundraising isn't going as great this time as it did 2 years ago. But he's in this thing.
Yeah, well, people don't really understand the whole concept of independent. And it really took Bernie many, many years in Vermont before people could understand what he was doing and who he was and what he, you know, and how you juxtaposition Democrat and independent and what
mm-hmm.
that means. And it took a while, but now people understand it.
Right.
And I'm hoping that the people in Miami-Dade pick up on it faster and start going for it.
Yeah, I hope so too.
And Broward.
Hey, Howie Klein, you know, Donald Trump is you have a piece coming up at Down with Tyranny tomorrow morning about Donald Trump. A delusional Trump wants the midterms to be all about him. Democrats can't believe their luck. He is making this about him. In there was the Kansas race was last week, but in the primary for governor, Kris Kobach now it turns out is the winner. He defeated in the primary. He defeated the sitting governor of Kansas, and I guess the party's not happy about that because they think Kris Kobach is a nut and he's going to have a harder time winning in the general. This is another
example.
Yeah,
I mean, not only do they think it. He is a nut,
yeah.
But not only that, they did polling on it.
Uh-huh.
And the polling showed very clearly that the Democratic candidate would beat Kobach, but could not beat whatever his name was, the guy who was appointed.
Collier,
he was the lieutenant
or something.
When Brownback left, this guy got appointed, or automatically became governor.
Right.
So, you know, that's a very strange situation when someone's not an elected governor.
Mm.
You know, there are a lot of voters who don't like that, and they very often lose. But he was elected lieutenant governor. In any case, it was very close. I think in the end, it was something like 200 or 300 votes separating them. And so Kovac is the winner. And, of course, the extremist Republicans are very happy about that. But so are the Democrats, because the Democrats feel if they have any chance to win this thing, it's going to be because they're up against Kovac, who is pretty much seen as too extreme for mainstream Republicans and way too extreme for independents. And, you know, Kansas is a very red state, but if all the Democrats stick together and pick up some Republicans and they pick up the independents, the Democrats win.
Yeah. So there's a chance there. And Donald Trump is talking about going out and, doing rallies 6 or 7 days a week as we get closer to the general election. This could backfire on him big time and help the Dems, you think?
Yes. He said he's going to do 50 rallies. And I don't know. I don't see it, but that's what he said. He just pulls these numbers out of his ass anyway. But he said he's going to do 50 rallies. The problem is that a lot of Republicans are saying, you know, please, campaign for me on Twitter, but do not
right.
come to my district. And, people who have primaries coming up, they all want Trump because, you know, that's how you win a Republican primary.
Right.
But people who have already had their primaries, they're not taking calls from the White House. They don't want him in their districts because he says he motivates Republicans to get out and vote. Okay. But he also motivates Democrats and independents to get out and vote
right.
against his candidate.
That's right.
So people would just rather do their Republican candidates and incumbents would rather do their own campaigns, a lot of them. I mean, look, if he goes to Alabama or he goes to Mississippi, sure, they want him. But even in Texas, there are districts, you know, that are very, very, very vulnerable for Republicans now. You know, districts around Houston, around Dallas, around Austin, around San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
Take my word for it. They don't want him coming to those
wow.
districts, and he's not going to understand that. He wants to go to Texas and campaign for Ted Cruz,
good
his old
letter.
Pal.
Uh-huh.
And the people running for Congress, the Republicans running for Congress in these vulnerable districts near the big cities, they feel that they're going to lose their seats if he shows up.
Right. Good. And his ego is going to make him show up.
Yeah, Ted Lieu said. Ted is the West Coast vice chair of the DCCC.
Right.
And Ted said if he could lure somehow Trump into California, they're going to win all the seats. That's how unpopular Trump is.
Wow.
And he said he would pay the permit fee for Trump to put on a rally in any place in California.
Uh-huh. Oh, that'd be great.
Yes.
It's
really funny.
Did I
He's
even
challenging
see,
Trump to come to California?
Did I see that Devin Nunes and his Democratic opponent are polling equal?
47-47.
That's
they are absolutely polling equal. But, you know, that was one poll. Most polls
right.
show that Nunes is winning. But Nunes normally wins by, like, a landslide.
Right.
2-1 landslide.
Uh-huh.
And now this guy, Jans, whether he wins or not, he's very, very close. So he could win. I don't know. I'm waiting for Vladimir Putin to endorse Nunes.
Right. Well, that'll come soon.
It may come soon. I don't know if you saw this or not, but Rolling Stone has a piece up today or yesterday that shows that the FBI is saying that the Russians jumped into the race in the 22nd district, which is, I'm sorry, not the 22nd district, the 45th district, no, not 45th, the 48th district, in Orange County, in order
for
to
Dan
help
Rohrabacher?
They want to help Rohrabacher, who the Russians love.
Yep.
And what they did is they went after the candidate that they thought was the strongest, and they tried to destroy him. And the FBI has the evidence that the Russians did this, and they did, you know, a series of cyber attacks against this guy, but they screwed up. So he did lose, but they wound up with a stronger Democratic candidate. They goofed up.
Wow. Well, good.
I think.
Yes, definitely. It works for us. Howie, we've got only a minute left. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you. I know she was not in the Warner Brother family of labels or anything, but do you have any Aretha stories?
Not any different than everybody else who just like loved Aretha Franklin and loved her music so much. I saw her so many times that I thought I probably booked her at Stony Brook when she was a very young woman.
Uh-huh.
And I asked a friend of mine who worked at the student activities board with me this morning. I said, "Didn't we have Aretha?" And he said, "No, we never did. We used to go see her all the time, but we didn't have her at the school."
Okay. Well,
I have no Aretha stories. Just love her music.
Me too. And we lost a great one today. Howie Klein of Down with Tyranny and the Blue America Pack. Thanks as always, Howie. And let's keep this progressive trend going the next few weeks. We could use it. Find Howie at Down with Tyranny and the Blue America Pack. Thank you, Howie.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And I will see you tomorrow. We're going to talk impeachment. Really?